Thursday house studios. So we're living in a time of exponential technological acceleration.
This is the 21st century. There's so many technological advancements that have happened.
Communications technologies allow us to have access to so many different ideas about what it means to be human.
Rampant technological advancements are affecting the societies that we live in.
It runs how our world is operating, how the decisions are made.
There's so many changes to identity, politics, everything.
We use so many different technologies and they all interact with ourselves in very different ways. This patchwork of experiences changes the way that you perceive reality.
An endless geographic plane of micromeshing, pulsing quanta, limitless webs of interacting blendings, leakings, mergings, weaving through ourselves, running rings around each other, heedless, needless, aimless, careless, thoughtless, amok.
There's a lot of noise about the purported merits and dangers of new technologies. Tiresome moral panics over video games. Hysteria about disinformation and deepfakes. Then there's legitimate concerns about how social media, algorithms, and facial recognition infiltrate our everyday lives and compromise our privacy. How do we begin to make sense of the sweeping changes new technologies are having on our society? And who do we turn to for answers? I'm Jake, I'm a curator, and I co-produced Defrag alongside Somerset House Studios. Defrag was a series of talks that took place between 2017 and 2019. A bit of an experimental series that was trying to take a look at how technology was changing art and culture, but also society more broadly.
Defrag. Here at Somerset House.
The defragmentation metaphor is something like when you used an old Windows computer and you had to defragment your hard drive because it was running slowly. The computer reorders the information that it's stored into ways in which it can access that information quicker or more efficiently. I guess the idea was to take a load of these different topics and try and make sense and store them in a more efficient manner within our minds in the room. The following audio montage meshes a range of fragmented thoughts from speakers across both series, exploring how technology is changing the world we live in, including the way we produce and consume art and culture, delving into the practices of the people utilizing and critiquing some of the latest technologies, and how these shape and augment our realities. Digital technologies and online spaces have become key to the creation and display of art for many artists, curators, and producers. These technologies have afforded cultural practitioners a raft of new opportunities. We hear from a range of people talking about how technology has influenced, helped their own creative practice. James Stringer
studied fine art
engine focus studio,
and I moved into working with technology quite early on. Much later started learning 3D stuff, mostly free kind of 3D programs, and doing YouTube tutorials, things like that.
Started out of necessity, basically.
Basically started using games engines because they were a means to an end to begin with.
So my wife and I were living between two countries, Mexico and London, and we were often apart and we wanted to continue our curatorial work with each other. So we created an online gallery both out of that geographical need but also our interest in digital art practices.
Primarily we are art critics.
The White Pube, Gabriella
De
La Puente.
The kind of holy trinity of the White Pube is like website, Twitter, Instagram. I should probably say like how well the internet has worked in our favour. And I think that the White Pube is where we are, and we're doing quite well because we're very good at the internet.
I use the internet every day.
Shannon SP,
being somebody who has like a diaspora history, it's been really important for me to be able to connect with other people that have those similar experiences. A lot of the effects of racism, or when you're any kind of marginalized person, being able to connect with other people who are going through the same things is really helpful.
I don't know how the internet works. I've got no idea. People have explained it to me and I think it's still magic. Like, I don't know what Wi-Fi is. I just know how to use it all. Because I'm like, one sec, let me Google it. That feels like the natural augmentation where it's between eye contact and let me pull the reference up or whatever it is that I want to like use as an analogy, so that you've got the same experience as I've got or something, and you can see the aesthetic experience of the internet in terms of like interaction. Like that feels right. So I really like that all this is happening.
In many ways, technology and commercial technologies like video game engines, like social media, have made it easier to make work and easier to get work in front of other people. One of the key things here also is the free access to technology to bolster either your job or your creative work.
Libby Heaney, who's a tutor at the RCA and an artist in residence here at Somerset House Studios.
I've been working with artificial intelligence for quite a while now, and before that, other types of technologies. I'll speak a little bit about the tech that I used and how accessible it is, because a good thing is that it is available online, deepfakes, face-to-face, something that I call deep video portraits. All the code for these types of things are on GitHub, which is a website which people share code on, and you can contribute to different repositories, and it's open source, basically.
Unreal Engine, which is where we put most of it together. It's a free program that you can download and put various media into it and create lots of different types of either interactive projects or video projects. We use it a lot just purely as a video editor. We create cinematics in it, music videos, things like that.
We were reaching out to artists and asking them whether or not they would be willing to share research material, content, or compose small compacted exhibitions with inside the location of a single zip file, which are free to download, free to share, reuse.
Why would we ever go through the like labor, time, cost of setting up a print publication? I don't like, we had the idea on a Monday and we launched the website, like we bought the domain there and then.
In terms of why Serena we set Muhammad, up a Twitter or an Instagram, it just kind of like seemed like one of those things, like of course we would set up a Twitter. How else are we meant to let people know that we're writing things?
Kaiken, which is a multidisciplinary collective that pushes the boundaries of the physical and the digital.
Recently, we've just been working with AR, and we've been kind of producing our own filters and
to
things.
To explore contemporary issues like climate change, data and wellness.
We think it's a really interesting medium to work with because it just creates this extra layer of reality, making it accessible to everyone. If you can ensure that this technology is in the hands of everyone and not just in the hands of the privileged few who have access to it, you can allow people to really just explore.
You can download this, and as long as you've got a PC that's got the graphics card on, that's suitable for training the AI model, you can start using it.
Self-publishing, even if it's, you know, a tweet, like it feels quite nice and it feels quite powerful.
Traditional 3D graphics are really expensive and take a long time, a lot of like money to render the images. You have to use render farms, you have to kind of like industrially produce the images, whereas with games engines, they are kind of designed to render images in real time, so it kind of worked out a lot cheaper.
I think that it was important that the series didn't just talk about art, but that we talked about how technology was hugely affecting society and the way that people live.
I love a bit of techno-utopianism, and there are many, obviously, a myriad of beneficial applications of technology.
That you can be a really emancipatory tool in so many different ways. I do have this kind of utopian ideal that through technology, and through the means in which you go about using it and creating it, we can kind of create these communities and connections with people that can, yeah, be much more positive and be really open.
We could reimagine genders or reimagine voices and work in these liminal spaces in between.
A lot of the kind of developments in technology is like developing of like computer brain interfaces. Imagine in the future if we could have kind of our vision would be augmented.
Being open to a human-machine recombination and
code
mutation
musician,
and not being too fearful of what it means to be human in the future.
So you would be able to actually wear a filter all the time. You might have digital clothes, your whole architecture of your space. And I feel like this is the kind of nascent stage that people are playing around.
I'd say that it's like hostile to kind of Luddism in relation to technology, or fear of the onset of automation and so on. I certainly got quite a positive relation with that.
When you start to look into the future, because of so much potential furthering of inequality, futures for people might be very, very different. You know, you might have a group of people that live in an augmented world, essentially.
Wider things that are happening in our political, social, economic systems. Society being hugely changed by new technological developments and practices that are being innovated and deployed all the time. What are some of the challenges about just casually releasing technologies into society without seriously thinking about how they're going to affect people and how they are going to be used and then but also abused by people?
Technologies are like a double-edged sword, right? There's definitely scary aspects to this, that's without a doubt.
The implications of these technologies, you know, ethically, morally.
The technologies are made to be addictive.
Yeah, and it's sensual, yeah. It's a fetish, you know, we stroke these things, we pour them, we hold them. It's an extension of our body, right?
Hypercapitalism, cultural capital, technology, endlessly scrolling through people and products. It's a hilarious meme next to a war crime, next to an advert, next to your aunt on holiday.
It's worth expressing that there is a sense of toxicity with filters as well, because there's been like a lot of beauty related filters that just augment your features. Like, they'll make your eyes bigger, they'll make your lips bigger, your nose smaller, your chin tucked.
The politics in the spaces that are built in VR are really weird. Like, women's bodies were being used for porn by guys in VR porn, early VR porn.
The discussion that's often had in terms of virtual reality is like, how virtual should we be getting or something? Like, what's the end game for this experience? Like, and will, in that journey, will we lose our humanity?
I guess essentially at what point augmented reality becomes augmented reality, at what point it becomes virtual reality, and at what point that's not necessarily just a very odd binary to be drawing between IRL and URL.
Everything we do on our smartphones, on the internet, on our computers is passively monitored, recorded, logged.
Surveillance technologies that we literally say yes to and invite into our personal spaces.
I think basically if you have an Alexa or a Google Home in your house, you're basically inviting MI5 into your lounge.
Being online is like, it's being in the public sphere. It's not private. There is no privacy.
Most devices are hackable. If the government really wants to get into my phone, it's getting into my phone. And that's through what they call equipment interference, is essentially hacking.
States and corporations are becoming ever more sophisticated in using these technologies for control and, you know, to mould societies in the way that they want. The oppressors are using technologies for control, and they will do so more and more.
If more and more this data is being stored about you, it can be centralised, you know, whoever holds that power, and that's very dangerous politically. And that's also where I think a lot of the danger of where technology is heading.
It was meant to be another type of utopia.
The pace of innovation and change and technological disruption is kind of unbelievable. I think it's sort of exponential to anything we've ever seen in human history before. And regulation is not able in any way meaningfully to keep up with this. We're constantly fighting against this thing. So I think it's almost like Pandora's box. You know, you've let this out now.
Totally.
And the finance and backing is there for all this stuff to happen.
New technologies have already begun to revolutionise scientific research, political campaigning, state surveillance, and much more besides. Meredith Whittaker, co-founder of NYU's AI Now Institute, has written that new technologies such as facial recognition are biased in how they work and how they're deployed, unleashed by powerful corporations, big companies, without checks and balances. And they're often created and implemented in obscurity, without public review or full accountability under the law.
So a lot of my work now is looking at
Gabriella Ivan,
how close we are to entering into a world where images and videos can be faked to a convincing standard.
Deepfakes. To my knowledge, sort of on Reddit, people began discussing deepfakes kind of around a load of guys who had produced an algorithm to put celebrities' faces on female porn stars. You kind of had these sort of tech bros develop an app called Deep Nude, where you could take pictures of people from social media and put it through their algorithm, which would remove all of their clothes, so you could create nudes of anyone whose image was out there. And it's sort of like, you know, disgusting use of this technology. Another really interesting way of the application of these technologies in Gabon. The president of Gabon had a stroke and was taken ill to a hospital in France. While he was in France, he was supposed to give this sort of New Year's Day speech that he gives every year. So his government actually commissioned a lot of researchers to produce a video of him delivering this speech, which actually ended in a unsuccessful military coup in Gabon. So it's kind of quite interesting the way that we perceive deepfakes as being something that sort of some nefarious actors are going to use to try and destabilize stable governments. Actually, in the developing world, you know, the consequences for this kind of technology is actually sort of much more severe and potentially violent.
To what extent are you certain when you see a report on social media reported against anyone? To what degree are you certain that this incident actually took place?
What I'm interested in is what will it do for the human rights world if you can't believe any of this visual documentation that you're seeing anymore? Then what does that mean? You can't trust anything. Verification becomes nearly impossible.
I think that deepfakes really embody a lot of our concerns and worries around the way in which technology could potentially manipulate and influence data and behaviours in the future. Deepfakes are one kind of iteration, if you like, one rhizomatic use of kind of data and tech, you know, to kind of manifest these synthesized videos or audio, things like that. But for me, it's much more about the deeper forms of computational propaganda that we interact with every day on our phones or on our computers. You know, they're much more insidious because now our culture is curated by machines.
Online abuse and harassment is a virus which is infecting the internet.
Charlotte Webb.
This is a social phenomenon that corrupts the potential for the internet to be a space of emancipation, of freedom and of relative safety.
And in a social media culture which has coaxed us into belief that to share is to be validated and to be connected, this coercion leaves us so vulnerable to the exploitation.
And there's been more bullying than ever on the internet since
Anne Dufault,
we've been
curator
kind
of A to Z.
Naming ourselves online and kind of using social media, which is quite interesting.
So this was on online violence against women.
Milena Marin.
We analyzed the largest open source analysis of tweets sent to women politicians and journalists. We found that one in 14 tweets that these women received was abusive or problematic, and we found that Black women were the most affected. They were, one in every 10 tweets received by Black women was abusive or problematic, and they were the actual victims of online abuse.
Amnesty actually released a poll where we polled women across 8 countries about their experiences of online abuse.
Caroline,
so we found
Singers.
That across the 8 countries, almost a quarter of women, so 23%, had experienced abuse or harassment. And then within that, half of the abuse that they had experienced was misogynistic. I think over a quarter of it included threats of physical or sexual assault.
The consequences of online abuse are felt in the real world very concretely. Our online experiences are just as real as our offline experiences.
You know, the effect of what happens online, or you know, our actions online have in real life, you know, effects.
A more pervasive and insidious form of attack comes in the form of the mainstream media. Online organized attacks can not only be seen as spearheaded by keyboard warriors, but it's critical we acknowledge the professional trolls who are actually employed to do this. Every day, social media platforms and online news outlets explode with government and media-backed actors who fuel racialized and gender harassment in order to influence and intimidate public opinion.
It's not technology. It's people who are using and deploying and making technology that are making big changes in our lives through the technology that we're using.
We want to avoid this idea of technological determinism.
Rafaela Moreira, UCL Multimedia Anthropology.
Or this idea that it is because of the technology that these things are happening.
It's important to note that technology doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's encoded with all the biases, prejudices, and directives of its makers.
Essentially, technology cannot exist without society, and society cannot exist without technology. So in some ways, the division between the two is kind of false, and really what we're worried about is the society that we're living in.
A common thread runs through many of the responses to the issues discussed across both series of Defrag, that commercial technologies and services are often more interesting when they're subverted and used in ways that designers didn't foresee.
The intentional and willful misuse of technologies to use them in better ways and for better purposes.
Necessity begets invention, and it's often thoughtful citizens, activists and artists pushing the boundaries of their roles as users and consumers that are at the forefront of democratic and responsible uses of technology.
Kind of squeezing the potential out of machines to do something other than what they were intended for. I see it as something to be hacked and repurposed into more productive or positive directions.
People do feel like I think they are hacking something.
So we're kind of hacking the bodies of famous influencers. We're kind of trying to use AI and machine learning technologies to influence the influencers and get them to say things that they never said before, which is a kind of very common theme throughout the use of generative forms of technology with regards to deepfakes, for example.
What we can do is, following Donna Haraway's kind of manifesto, is be a cyborg, is learn how to use these technologies for the resistance.
Artists will sort of engage with that, with the digital, and comment.
But we wanted to kind of, to hack their bodies, really, and use their personal data in unexpected ways. as a metaphor, really, for the ways in which our own personal data is used in countless opaque ways that we'll never fully know and understand. So engage with some more of the kind of philosophical implications around data and privacy and technology.
An all-seeing eye over everything that private citizens and civil society is doing.
And kind of use the arts as a vehicle for kind of being provocative, but also interrogating these wider issues, really.
The environment that we're
Sophie
all
Carlo,
living
in Big Brother Watch.
Has changed beyond all recognition. Today, privacy is kind of in the eye of the storm in relation to the press on Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and so on.
My personal practice has been really informed by Dada and by the Situationist art movements, you know, really kind of taking a kind of key method, if you like, that they use, which is detournement. Means rerouting or hijacking, you know. So I'm very much interested in detourning forms of power. And my practice really has been centered on kind of interrogating and challenging propagandas. But it's very interventionist. It's an activist practice. And I think with deepfakes especially, there's a lot of fear and mistrust, you know, around how our data is being used. And we seek to work with others from different sectors to explore, interrogate, and try and make these really complex, obscure things relational and accessible.
Bill Posters and Libby Heaney kind of appropriating deepfake technologies is fascinating to see, you know, artists just picking up these tools, using them, making jokes with them, and then all of us are kind of a little bit more in the know through their labours.
It's up to us to find ways to use technologies for resistance and to see how these technologies can facilitate, you know, new forms of dialogue, new forms of exchanging of ideas, new forms of action. That is where the hope lies, really. It's up to us to come together and think how we can use these technologies for emancipation and for resistance, because, you know, we can be sure that the states and corporations are using them for oppression. They will do so ever, you know, in increasingly kind of powerful and scary ways.
The government intercepts undersea cables. I mean, it intercepts bulk communications, all internet traffic, phone communications, the lot. Encryption simply is just the practice of encoding information. So, you know, using encryption to shield those communications from being looked at, read, monitored, logged, is a sensible thing to do. Encryption was particularly important, you know, in World War II, for example, where you had lots of encoding and code-breaking machines and so on. I think it would have been difficult for anyone to predict the new relevance that encryption would have in the digital age, where now most of us are advised to use what is could be regarded as historically quite a militaristic technology. Big Brother Watch, the organisation that I work for, are strong defenders of encryption. Really easy to use end-to-end encryption tools didn't used to be very easy to find, but they now are. On the one hand, encryption has been commercialised, but encryption has been democratised too because of its availability in what we call open source or free software. So Signal, for example, I would urge you to download Signal and just start moving all of your conversations there.
Why do we need encryption?
Encryption is really important to protect our freedoms, our privacy, our freedom of speech, freedom of thought as well, because we do realise that if we don't have those other freedoms, we also risk sort of not even thinking for ourselves anymore.
Almost exclusively, everybody was just sort of like really unimpressed with who controls technology and how uncritically it's used daily by lots of people. You know, that you just kind of fall into these traps. Like Pavlov's dogs, they ring the bell, we
drool and read and scroll and swipe and buy and click and play and take selfies.
The emergence of open source investigations and open source intelligence.
Open source intelligence is a really interesting field for kind of appropriating repressive technologies.
In essence, sort of the use of publicly available information from satellite imagery to social media posts in order to investigate a wide range of issues in the public interest.
So the military and law enforcement have been using open source intelligence for years and years. So looking through our social media posts, there's public webcams that they look at, access to flight details through like open sensors tracking which flights are flying over to which places. FOIA requests are something that we as like the citizens can use to access information. So I became interested in open source intelligence as a way to flip the narrative.
I don't care about the US Army narrative. I believe that the most compelling narrative is the narrative of people on the ground who've been affected by war. And that's the narrative we are trying to say.
To have access to more information that is out there, you just have to kind of know how to look. Publicly available data, which is what open source investigations are, ethics, media forensics, what is truth, these kind of questions.
You can get groups of people online to process huge amounts of data, and you can build a body of evidence that you can use in an international criminal court or in select committees or oversight committees and make a case for the fact that, you know, if the UK government says they are not bombing these people in Syria, and then you show that there's evidence, well, actually, you are. I think that can be a really great use of those kind of commercially available technologies being used in a way that they weren't necessarily made to be used for.
The war in Syria, our focus was, you know, the international coalition's campaign against the so-called Islamic State in Syria and Iraq is really one of the first to be documented en masse by civilians, militants, and state militaries alike, and they're all uploading content to the internet in near real time. And this content is being hosted on the social media platforms that we all, or most of us, use every day to document our realities.
So let's say that there was an airstrike here in Somerset House. There will be lots of citizens around, and pretty much in Syria, every single citizen has a smartphone. And everyone kind of have a Twitter account or a Facebook account. And they all post about what's happened. They post pictures, videos, names of the locals who were killed. So we capture these allegations and put them in one incident.
YouTube never set out to be an archive for war crimes, and that's what they became.
Hannah Rullman, Air Wars.
The way it works is that the researchers at AirWars, they monitor local media sources or social media sources, and everything that they find goes into a research document, like a compilation of by date and by source, and then the assessors go back to these research documents and summarize that in the amount of people killed, people who are named in these reports, the location, and then that goes into a spreadsheet and creates this database which we base all of our statistics on.
So our method at Amnesty is to combine field investigations with open source or remote investigations. And we've been doing that for a long time. We have a team, I'm part of a team at Amnesty called Evidence Lab. And our goal is to support Amnesty researchers to really push human rights investigations and research into this century. And not just rely on testimonies, but corroborate those testimonies with irrefutable evidence. And that is analysis of satellite imagery. We can now corroborate when somebody tells us my building was bombed, we can see that in satellite images and we can bring that compelling evidence. When they say they used indiscriminate artillery, we have a weapons expert that can analyze remnants of ordnance and can tell us which bomb it was, where it was manufactured, who was using it, who sold it, and so on. We use verification of any social media reports we find. So, you know, images, videos, we corroborate the location, we corroborate the date, we corroborate the content of the video. So we bring all that together with the testimonies to really make an irrefutable case that civilian lives were lost. So we were able to verify where exactly this video was filmed. We were able to verify who were the people. We were able to verify the weapons they used, the uniforms they were having. We found the military base where they belonged to. So all this eventually led to them being suspended, and there's an active investigation against this military, these soldiers.
Because I'm a human rights researcher, but also a technologist. So I started to write tutorials on how you would gather flight data or how you would find webcams that are publicly available that people don't know that they have connected to the internet.
Our goal is change, and we can change people if we can change people's opinions, and including the coalition, if we show incredibly compelling evidence. At some point, we find strategies that get to where it hurts them.
Welcome, everybody, to the Feminist Internet Digital Clinic.
The Feminist Internet Collective.
We are artists and designers who believe in the power of creativity and criticality to transform how the world unfolds and how it is understood. We believe there is a need to go beyond current definitions and images of gender, race, and class. We are using our imaginations and our collective solidarity to intervene in the development of the web to ensure it promotes gender equality, equal rights, and justice for all. Online abuse and harassment is a virus which is infecting the internet, and we want to collectively produce antibodies that are going to build some immunity and fight this infection.
The feminist internet. Their metaphor was that abuse on the internet is a virus, but then they kind of acted, I mean, like a retrovirus, that you kind of co-opt the same spaces that abuse exists within, and then you, create your viral content, and then you spread your message throughout those same spaces and try and combat things like this.
Transform ourselves into antibodies and become agents of change. Platforms need to really question their responsibility to immunise themselves and protect their users against these types of infections.
Caroline Sinders.
We're thinking of ways to use different kinds of technology to analyse harassment and then create products and solutions towards mitigating harassment. So what that means is I work with engineers and technologists to then turn software capabilities and things like APIs and algorithms into products. I've also been studying online harassment and protests for the past 5 years.
It's possible for us
Rhiannon
to use
Williams,
online organized group attacks to sort of map political and social change, or at least the moods and how people are feeling on a larger sort of scale. If we pay attention to who's saying what about who and why, we can almost predict the changes that might be on the horizon.
What's been really positive is watching how a community has been organised to fight back and clap back to create alternative modes of internet. So there's an incredible black queer artist called Zana who created an alternative internet social space away from Facebook, away from Twitter, for queer and trans people of colour in London to access, that were safe from these regulation rules that we were talking about. And I thought that was a really interesting and positive way to push back against it. I think my advice would be that we have an active agency in how we interact with the internet. We have controls and boundaries, and we shouldn't just be passive, meaning you can set up what you want to make sure that your internet experience is healthy as possible.
Call them out, hold them to account, and create a space for more independent media.
So if you see online abuse, report it. Report it on someone else's behalf. You don't need to know them. Take that emotional burden off that person, because they're going to be dealing with so much more.
Shay Akiwola.
Don't be part of the problem and tell somebody else. So there's 80 people in the room? If you all tell somebody else, 160 people are now more aware of online violence as a form of violence.
I do believe that recognising where the hatred comes from is fundamental to then preventing it. So while a perfect smackdown to someone who's just attacked you could make them think twice about doing it again, only education will challenge their core beliefs.
Interactive and informative training workshops on online hate speech and violence against women and girls. for young people and online tech companies as well.
And that's what will eventually dismantle this whole violent system from the roots upwards.
New digital spaces are being used to question a variety of contemporary social, political, and technological issues. But physical spaces are also being repurposed to accommodate new ideas. Yeah, the impact of technology on social spaces that we exist in, whether these are digital spaces like social media, to then physical spaces, which technology is kind of being repurposed within to kind of help different communities or different practitioners or artists kind of consider ideas. I think
London's
that
Zero
at Corsica Studios, is a really interesting example of a night, a club night in a physical space that's being used to host kind of radical ideas about society.
We had an interest in producing some kind of club experience that was more than just people going and getting drunk and high and raving, and which is all good, but we wanted more than that.
Something that kind of cross the intersection of like art and music.
So the main room in Corsica Studios, room one, is the room that we turn into installation, and we use a small room to do the party. The reason we chose Corsica Studios is because it's got very intense sound systems. The rave is in a small room with lots of smoke and one laser and a stack of subwoofers up to the ceiling. And the installation room is not there as an escape from the party. It's there to try and do what installations do as intensely as possible. So actually it's not about you go in there to unwind after dancing. It's in that you go in there to focus, pay attention, concentrate. It started to do with kind of alternative futurisms. This idea of non-Western or diasporic futurisms was something that we're interested in. Certain ideas to do with Afrofuturism were quite important. Cyberpunk fiction, William Gibson, or Bruce Sterling, obviously well-known films like Terminator and Blade Runner, Robocop and The Matrix. Also how that's dealt with in certain currents of philosophy and writers like Ballard, the Anthropocene and climate change and so on.
Building new sort of speculative futures as a means of sort of testing out ideas around things like inequality or sort of the potential for new paradigms to emerge. You've programmed some extremely thoughtful artworks. I'm thinking about Lee Gamble and Sam Keating Fry's installation Passive Scan, which used IMSI catches to sort of scrape personal data from people's phones in the audience as they went in. The works are generally actually all asking quite tough questions about the nature of the world that we're all living in. Zero is kind of a celebration of the potential for change, potential for new ideas.
That kind of gets to the heart of what we're trying to do, putting some of this material in a more accessible space and trying to facilitate people paying attention, focusing, concentrating, learning, a more thoughtful club environment.
You know, a nightclub is not the kind of place you would normally see a critique of colonialism or a critique of surveillance capitalism or a critique of stop and search. But actually, it's really kind of an amazing place to have those ideas being explored in front of audiences of young people who may not have heard or come across those ideas.
People were just sat on the floor having like really deep conversations about race, about erasure, about cultural appropriation, while there was a rave going on next door.
If you put something in a club space that demands attention, concentration, focus, thinking, you immediately create a space that is where people are literally more thoughtful about what's going on, but also where they are, who's around them.
Some of them may not have necessarily ever thought about these things before. So in that sense, it was people coming for one thing and learning about another thing.
I think the future does hold a lot in store for us. And from, you know, the kind of Star Trek-y ridiculous cyborg eyes to just really awful crimes against humanity, like the massacre of the Rohingya or the consistent inequality of democracy and representation in society through tech companies and their influence, greedy politicians who, you know, are lobbied or are just out of touch and can't kind of regulate these systems. On the other side, there's some really amazing work being done by so many people from so many different disciplines, whether it's science fiction writers, anthropologists, artists, or just everyday people in their homes, figuring out sort of what the consequences of all these technologies being thrown at us are. And I think it's really exciting to live through this moment where there is such great tension and there are quite dramatic swings from one side to the other about excitement and depression, promise and repression. I think it is a really quite amazing, unique time, and I think everything is up for grabs. We all have a responsibility to think critically about the way that we consume things, about the way that we use things. And the more that we can kind of understand the way that these technologies are used, or the way that we use technology, the more we can interfere with them, we can change them, we can make them more human. I think technology has really amazing potential to increase our humanity, not to just make us numbers or just make us data. I think it can do some really beautiful and creative things. Yeah, we just have to be careful. I think we have to be careful that we don't just roll over and let things happen to us, that we are active and that we resist, bodge, hack, undermine, misuse, subvert anything and everything that comes our way. We'll be right back.